This podcast series is brought to you from the University of Winchester. We invite you to listen in as we talk with both academics and practitioners about their approaches to peace building and conflict transformation, discussing some of the most complex and pressing challenges we face in the world today.
So, I'm Simon Keyes from the University of Winchester Centre for Religion, Reconciliation and Peace. Welcome to this podcast. I'm delighted to be speaking to Professor Mohamed Amunima, who is a professor at the American University School of International Service and also senior advisor to CICID, one of the major interfaith initiatives in the world at the moment. So we met recently at a conference, online conference, and we started talking about dialogue, a subject in which both of us have a lot of interest, I think. We had slightly different takes on it, so we would just want to explore that for a few minutes together. Mohamed, in the presentation I made to the conference, I spoke about the value of David Bohm's ideas about dialogue, a sort of pure form of dialogue that is about encouraging people to get beyond the sort of fragmentation of consciousness and find a way of thinking together about complex issues. And obviously that's quite a pure idea of dialogue. It's been criticized by practitioners in the field as being a little bit too utopian. I just wonder what your view on the value of David Bohm might be.
Thank you, Simon, for hosting me. It was a pleasure to join you, and I'm really pleased that we met in that meeting and we have that simulation conversation. Also, in particular, regarding dialogue and David Bohm work, I've been teaching a dialogue for over 30 some years, and specifically David Bohm for the last 15 or 16 years at the American University. And every year I hear the same critique and the same excitement about David Bohm text on communication and on dialogue. And I agree, it is in the pure, maybe ideal, abstract, but I think it's a great way to conceptualize and diagnose the problem in human communication and in people communication in a conflict, and why people continue to repeatedly do the same mistakes in conflict and in disagreements. And I think his thesis regarding fragmentation, regarding the collective thoughts and individual thoughts and the link between them is absolutely genius. And I think in many ways it's brilliant in the way it helps people become aware of their mechanical way of thinking.
Yeah.
Which in many ways in a conflict setting caused the habituated system of conflict. I can't speak on abstract, I have to give example. In Sri Lanka, in Palestine, in Ireland, in Nigeria, in the US on race relation, on refugees issue in Europe, there are certain patterns of thoughts. If you're not able to break away from them, then we're not going to get anyway in the resolution of these conflicts, and also in understanding the perspective of the other. David Bohm come and say, look, here is your conscious and perception. It's a machine that's working according to certain set of perceptions and thoughts. You have been trained in it, and the problem, consciously, you're not aware that you are experiencing and causing others in this. So I'm very excited about it. But again, I always combine it with Isaac Book. I think Isaac Book come to say, okay, you guys think it is abstract, I'm going to translate it to you. And he takes it to the corporate world to say, here is how it works. But I think the best way is really to start with David Bohm, understand his philosophy, understand the framework of interaction, and then do the dialogue itself. There is no substitute for doing the dialogue hands-on in order to understand the meaning of a breaking away from the misperception and the mechanical way of wrongdoing.
That's very interesting. So I have a little motto for myself when I'm trying to set up difficult conversations, which is don't mention David Bohm. Because I find that it introduces a kind of anxiety in the participants, that they have expectations that there's going to be some big breakthrough from this new process that they haven't discovered before. And when you start talking about some of Bohm's ideas about fragmentation and hollow movement and all those things, you lose people very quickly, I think. So it's made me think that we need to find a way of preparing people for dialogue that isn't too theoretical. It doesn't create anxiety, but at the same time enables people to begin to develop this self-consciousness about the way they think, and particular about the way perhaps their assumptions, their prejudices and so forth can be explored in a creative way in dialogue. How do you approach this question of preparing people for a good dialogue?
Yeah, I think, you know, just to distinguish the conversation between academics and the school setting and the students versus the practice. I think in the practice, none of us start with David Bohm. None of us really start with the theory. What we do, I think, and it's the key behind the dialogue, you focus on individual, personal relationship building.
Yeah.
That's the stepping stone. That's the initial step. Once you manage to create some level of a trust among individuals and among members of the group, then I think within you know, a certain time, you're able to go from the individual identity to the collective identity. So then you can move into more the difficult conversation collectively, which I think where dialogue should be going, rather than only, as David Owen say, only on the individual fellowship. His assumption that the individual fellowship will eventually generate this solidarity among people. But I think that does not happen if you do not introduce the collective identity. So my preparation for any dialogue is to say, look, all I need you to do is to tell your story. See, the storytelling in the dialogue is a powerful tool. And if you manage to construct the container of dialogue in a way that you and me and others who are different from each other sitting around the table or without a table, sitting in circle, and then we share the pain, we share honestly the injuries that we have had, experienced as a result of this relationship. I think if you put people on that journey, that's first step. And that's, I think, the crucial part of it. The difficulty, I don't know if you face that as well, the difficulty is really with the question, is your dialogue going to solve the conflict? Yeah. What's the contribution of dialogue to the conflict? And that's, I think, where the difficulty with David Bohm. David Bohm says, do not present dialogue as a way to solve conflict. Dialogue is really for developing relationships, sustainable, regardless of the conflict. And people who live in a conflict don't have that luxury, don't have that not only luxury, but, you know, space, time, resource, energy. And some people ethically would say it's not right to go to Gaza now or to go to Lebanon or to go to any other place that has experienced trauma and say, I'm not going to talk about your conflict or solve your conflict. I'm going just to have 6 meetings aimed at getting to know each other. People are under a huge pressure to do that. So I usually say, look, we will get to know each other, but not only for the sake of knowing each other. We will have a topic. We will have a task. But I cannot tell you what the task is. You have to decide on that. And for you to reach that task, to define the problem you want to focus on, you need to go through knowing each other.
Yes.
I think that's the way I have usually prepared it.
Thank you. That's extremely helpful. So I can see Isaac's influence coming in there about dialogue going through a number of phases, for instance.
Yes.
So we don't have to abandon what seems to me a key point about Bohm. And he says this is not a decision-making process. Let's not specify what the outcome is going to be. Let's see where we end up. But let's concentrate in the first instance on listening to each other so that we can begin to establish a degree of trust and confidence.
Simon, but you know, I've written about this in my dissertation, actually, in 1992, dealing with dialogue between Arabs and Jews inside Israel. And also later on in Sri Lanka, in Ireland, in many other countries where conflict, I work with dialogue. I noticed the same problem, the same challenge usually. And it really has to do with persuading, convincing people to take the risk, to step in, to know the other person before demanding from the other person, I need you to agree that the situation needs to change. Yes. And that's where the most of the challenge of it. Once you let go of the precondition for dialogue, you're opening the path for a change in your perception and in the other perception. And again, these phases are important because some people sacrifice the level of individual acquaintance and knowing each other individually. I mean, I want to know who's your family, who's your children, what type of football team you support. I hope Liverpool in the context of the English league. I want you to know, you know, where did you grow up? What food you like? Without these small details about who are you, I will not be able to listen to your conflict and your injury. And let's not sacrifice that. But where the problem is, many of the dialogue, and I found that in the late 80s already, many of the dialogue group constructed from the majority, from the dominant group. And when the dominant group initiate the dialogue, member of that group somehow by default become protective of the status quo. Yeah. And therefore don't want to change the structure. Member of the minority group, when they come to the dialogue, they have only one objective. Not only to tell their stories, but the main objective is to change the structure that is it produces their grievances. And unfortunately, many dialogue group get stuck in the personal, get to know you, get to know your culture, make friends. And that's not fair to the dominated minority group who says, I did not come here to make friends. I came here to solve the structural problem. And that's where the dilemma with the power relation that we also talked about it earlier.
Yes, indeed. Yes, yes. So giving people really clear expectations as to where the dialogue is going and what it might achieve is obviously an important part of the preparation, isn't it? One other thing you mentioned there, though, which I'm very interested in, is I think you mentioned this when we spoke in the Initiatives for Change conference, was that there are different cultural understandings of dialogue. And in particular, people's loyalty to their group may become a very important barrier to people being able to speak as free, determining individuals with a sense of agency. Could you share some thoughts on that?
Yeah, and I think that's another take on the, it's known between the high context and low context culture, you know, context yeah. culture that look at the individualistic versus the collective, you know, working with the, in a collective culture like the Middle East, the Arab world, or even South Asia, is different from working with, you know, individualistic European or American in many ways, this difference could make a different construct, different ways of thinking about dialogue and about identity. So a model of dialogue that come based on a process that is fully individualistic on the individual responsibility will fail to produce as much products or success or a change if it doesn't take into consideration the fact that the people who come from the collective have a clan, tribe, political party, yeah. Family, people. These have religion, have gender. These are collective identities that we need to incorporate them into the dialogue process and have the conversation collective rather than individualistic only. And throughout the 30 some years of work in this, I have learned that it's not either or. We can't say, you know, a Muslim, a Nigerian person is only collective. Within that collective of the Nigerian, there is also a core individual. So how can we bring a dialogue process that combine between the individual needs as well as the strong collective loyalty. Because one of the basic communication dialogue, you say to tell them in the group, I don't want you to say we the Muslim and you the Christian. I want you to say I am Muhammad and you're Simon. And that itself, is a condition that perpetuate asymmetric power relation and give Simon's culture, which is individualistic, an edge over Muhammad culture, which is collective. So you using tools that already bias toward one cultural orientation.
That's very, very interesting. Thank you for explaining that so well. Our time is running out. I'd just like to ask you about one other element, which is I was very struck by something you said when we spoke before, that you feel we're living in an age of anti-dialogic culture. Could you say a little bit more about that and what you meant by that?
Yeah, I was referring really to the deterioration in the multilateralism, internationally, what we're looking at political development and context, whether it is in the Middle East region or in America or in Europe. I live in those three zones every month, and I see development where political leadership is pushing toward a competition, lack of cooperation, even justifying violence in the name of religion or in the name of ideology, the issue of racism within the US or the issue of anti-immigration and xenophobia in Europe or Islamophobia, the issue of in the Middle East as well, the pressure on youth, on people, and lack of a space for them to express and bring in their needs and desire into governance. These dynamics that we're surrounded by around the world is really pushing young people as well as older people to be more protective of their individualistic interests. And we see the trends of that in the way we consume the media, the social media, and the space for dialogue. It's a unique space. There you have to take the time to ask the person about themselves. It's not a culture. The dialogue has a culture of being interested in the person, where they come from. You want to learn their stories. It's not one line in social media and then you go to the next one. But also in general, maybe I was talking more as an American who's basically living in a very difficult 8 years or 4 years of governance that has pushed for more polarization, less cooperation, and really defunding many of the programs and many of the initiatives that call for multilateral, multi-cooperation between nations. And that's where in the last 4 or 5 years, our society in the US and also, I'm sorry, not society, our leadership in the US and also elsewhere have been pushing us. And I think that's where dialogue come in. We need dialogue during these days in order to make sure that we understand the value of learning and meeting each other, regardless if we're able to solve the conflicts or not.
Thank you. Yes, I mean, it strikes me that aspects of that anti-dialogic culture you talk about are the kind of desperate need for certainty and simplicity, one-dimensional views of the world. And it strikes me that dialogue is essentially a subversive force because it actually demands people come to terms with complexity.
But also
see the value of uncertainty.
Antidote. Value is the antidote. Dialogue is the antidote for this simple. And I've seen it in so many conflict areas. When you feel insecure, when you feel lack of resources, threats in the resources, then the first instinct, intuitive human instinct, to go back to preserve yourself, instead of reaching out with your hand to the other and say, what can we do in order to cope with the stress of a disaster? Or we see this in the COVID reality. We've seen it in the COVID reality, in the COVID-19 reality, how in the beginning we all went into shrank into our families, our home to protect ourselves. And then we realized this virus is transnational, transgenerational, transcontinental, we need to cooperate in order to overcome it. If UK doesn't do its job in containing it, France will be affected. And that's the type of dialogue space needed to solve a common human problem called COVID-19. And I think we need to be learning the lesson, at least from this one as well.
Yeah. So just final question then. You and I both believe in the power and the importance of dialogue and what Boehm calls the generation of impersonal friendship and the huge value that that has in the world as it stands at the moment. Where should we be focusing our energy on creating dialogue at the moment?
I don't think it's a choice of where, you live at 24 hours, let's say you sleep, 6 hours, 7 hours in an hour each. You have a choice. It's an individual choice in our life. I don't think it's a matter of in education or politics or economy or religion or in any other area. I think, look, dialogue is a set of ways of thinking that need to be integrated in every aspect of life if we are serious about bringing a human conscious to evolve into collaborative, cooperative, peaceful, and non-violence. And the good news that there are governments, systems in Europe and around the world as well, who realize that, and their education system have made a space for dialogical skills, for listening, for communication, for meeting the other, the awareness on multiculturalism and meeting other people who are different. There are lots of good practices from Canada to Senegal, to any other part of the world you can select. There are good examples in these places. What we need to do is to adopt it systematically, to adopt it in the global governance system, on the national, regional governance system. And I think that's where we need to be moving forward.
Yeah, that's Mohammed, thank you so much. I would love to continue this conversation. I hope we get a chance to meet face to face before too long to continue this. At Winchester, we are discussing trying to create a dialogic culture in the university as a whole. And that mirrors what you've just said about it's not just about dialogue events. It is about a way of thinking, critical thinking, being open to difference and understanding the power of conversation to give to enrich people's understanding, not only of each other, but of the issues they face. So,
precisely. I mean, I work in two institutions, American University and in CAICID, and in the American University, we managed to make actually dialogue sessions on campus available to all students. Every semester, 8-9 sessions you can join. And actually, as part of our initial education, people can receive that. But unfortunately, they have that chance only in university. So you have the high school and the entire period. And in CAICID, we work on with governments, with international agencies, and with religious institutions to convince them, persuade them to integrate dialogue as an integral part of their institutional policy. To integrate interreligious dialogue as part of the European Union, part of the United Nations, part of the ASEAN, African Union, Arab states as well, and also convince the Catholic Church and the Muslim Mufti in 57 countries and the Jewish rabbinical institution and Hindu and Buddhist. Convince them all that without integrating dialogical principles in their institutions, in the preparation of their clergy, we cannot overcome the disease of manipulating religious identity to justify violence. And that's where we talk about institutionalization of the principle of dialogue in all our life.
Yeah. Mohammed, thank you. We must stop there. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.